Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the OIES China Programme Podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. I'm joined today by Michael Meiten, who's Director, and Anders Hover and Philip Andrew Speed, who are Senior Research Fellows of the China Programme at the OIES. Now, we're here today to discuss the 2023 key China themes and to give an update from OIS's perspective on China energy. Now, just to timestamp this recording, we're recording it on the morning of Thursday, the 26th of January, 2023. Michael, Anders and Philip, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
Hi, David. It's great to be back and happy New Year of the Rabbit.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
Great to be with you again. Thank you.
Okay, well, look, Michael, let's just kind of start by setting the stage. You know, what do you expect for China energy demand, given China's reopening? You know, what are the short-term measures the government is taking, and also, what is their impact?
I mean, there's been, and of course, we talked about this when we did the sort of key themes for OIES podcast, about the dramatic U-turn that we've seen in China. And that's not just the changes on zero COVID, it's really on many policy sort of principles that have really been underlying the Chinese economy for the past 2-3 years. We're seeing much more support for recovery in the real estate after a very strong crackdown, easing restrictions on private enterprise and technology companies, an emphasis on reinvigorating consumption, and really the policy statements that we've seen since December, since the Central Economic Work Conference, and now in kind of the annual guidance from Liu He in Davos and the World Economic Forum, is very much a strong pro-growth agenda. Sort of China's back to perhaps tried and tested measures of big infrastructure projects coming through state-owned financing, which are obviously quite supportive for commodity demand overall, for oil, gas, and coal and other minerals in China. I think there are also, however, a number of questions about the vulnerabilities in the Chinese economy. There is, from speaking to contacts in China, a real sense of crisis, both in terms of the economic outlook and potentially the social implications of weaker economic growth. Demographics are an issue, of course. We've seen the latest reports on the drop in the population in China. Debt, still a huge concern. And we have a new leadership that's coming in March. Of course, the leadership transition happens in two parts. One is the party changeover that we had in October. The other is the government changeover that happens in March. We have fewer economists in this leadership group, less central government expertise than in the past. So really quite a few concerns that despite these efforts to open up the economy, the strength of sort of pent up demand, these efforts will fall short and or deepen some of the long term sort of stresses or challenges in the Chinese economy. So really a huge amount of uncertainty about how this kind of U-turn plays out. On balance, I think we're of the view, and this is what sort of we wrote in the 2023 outlook, that after a weak first quarter that could potentially extend into the first half, when infections peak and the real estate sector does start to recover, we do get more sort of confidence in consumption and we are looking at quite a strong second half of the year. Now, the extent again to which that extends into 2024 and the implications for longer term sustainability, both economic and environmental, are really some of the key things that we'll be watching out for throughout the year, but very much a year of two halves with a weaker first half and a very strong second half.
Anders, so you know, can I come to you? You know, as we've discussed before, you know, China has experienced severe electricity outages in the past 2 years. So now, how do you think the reopening looks for electricity?
Yeah, I think that when we're looking at China reopening trade from outside of China, we tend to think in terms of regular consumers, as well as perhaps in terms of the supply chain. But it's important to note, as Michael already said, that there's heavy demand coming from industry. And it really depends more on the stimulus measures in industry to see whether the electricity demand growth would take off most spectacularly. It's also notable that China was actually sort of open from a consumer perspective for most of the years of the pandemic. And actually last year was experienced a 13% increase in residential energy consumption, not because people were just staying at home, but because of severe climate conditions. So, and especially in the summer, but also in the winter. So I think that the comps, if you will, from year to year on residential consumption would not be as amazing, even if there's sort of a reopening trade there. So I think that in terms of whether there would be another outage, it really would depend on, more on the climate conditions than on the industrial growth, because essentially what we experienced in 2022 was the world's largest and longest heat wave in terms of the area and the number of people affected and the temperature increase that was experienced. And although extreme weather events are becoming more common, I wouldn't expect that to happen every year.
So Mikhail, can I come back to you? Because a question about kind of trade, the whole reopening of trade, you know, what do you think it means for oil and gas? And, you know, do you think we'll see LNG recover to the levels, you know, prior to the invasion of Ukraine?
I mean, if we start with gas, really, that's where industry is critical. It will depend on the strength of industrial recovery. Definitely, I think there will be, again, some growth, whether it's skewed to the second half of the year, and that's when we see most of the gas demand growth. But what does it mean for LNG specifically? That's sort of an open question. We are highly likely to see more domestic output. The oil and gas majors had a record or a very strong year in terms of profits last year, which are likely to be reinvested in CapEx spending, mainly on gas. So domestic gas production is set to increase. There's also an increase in flows from Power of Siberia 1. Again, they're ramping up towards the 38 BCM in 2025. So certainly more domestic in pipeline, but I do think that there will be more LNG demand. It goes back to prices. Industrial consumers are slightly price sensitive, and anecdotally, you sort of hear them saying that above $20 per MMBTU spot, they will take, sort of the tier two buyers will take more spot LNG. But with the economy recovering, I think the majors will also be picking up some of the term contracts that they didn't necessarily take last year. Remember, those are, a lot of them are oil indexed. Some of the new SPAs are Henry Hub linked. So the prices are less eye-watering than spot LNG will be. Going back to the pre-Russian invasion of Ukraine, we have to remember that 2021 was an exceptionally strong year. So we're unlikely to see that kind of a growth, but we do expect sort of LNG imports to recover this year. Probably a sort of 6 to 8 BCM increase is what we have penciled in for now. Oil depends both on the macro outlook. Mobility and transport are a big factor for this year, and we've already seen the Lunar New Year with more people going home, and that's kind of gasoline and jet demand. With international travel recovering, again, that's a boost for jet. But it also depends on policies, because the crude import licenses that are given to the independents inform how much buying can come from that sector, and we've seen a large batch of import quotas already being given at the beginning of the year, as well as product export quotas, again, which allow refiners to export. There's a shortage of diesel in Europe, and that will only be exacerbated by the EU ban on Russian oil products. So, you know, there are opportunities there for Chinese refiners to export products. In that respect, oil demand growth is linked to policies. And I think that's also where, for now, we've had very strong quotas at the beginning of the year, and I think that's front-loading on sort of some economic activity. The extent to which we see equally large quotas coming in the second half of the year, that will be an indicator of where the government is trending in this, if we call it a slightly oversimplistic balance of pro-growth versus environmental sustainability.
Now, Anders, I keep kind of hearing about, you know, energy security as kind of the top priority. So, you know, do you think the energy transition is taking a backseat then?
Yes, I think that we all understand that energy security has been a top priority for some number of years. But I think that also it's important to remember that that was also the case even a few years ago when Xi Jinping launched the 2030-2060 carbon peaking and carbon neutrality goals. It's not that energy security is really a new topic. It has increased in importance, but it is still energy transition and low carbon transition are very much still on the agenda and very much still a government priority. And I think that to remind ourselves how big a government priority and how big a reputational stake has been placed on the low carbon energy transition, I would go back to Xi Jinping's comment, which was really directed at Western countries. If you say it, do it. If you can't do it, don't say it. And really, that is kind of, for me, an indication that the government is absolutely going to adhere to the 2030, 2060 targets. But of course, those targets are relatively long-term, and that does allow for wiggle room on, for example, building new coal plants, increasing carbon emissions from heavy industry, and so forth. I think that in terms of the energy transition as well, we have to look not only at new coal plant construction, but also the accelerating installations of renewable energy and the accelerating adoption of electric vehicles. Now, these are big numbers that come out of these sectors. So solar, for example, almost 90 gigawatts of solar were installed last year. And then for electric vehicles, we're now over a 1/3 share of the market, up from just 5% 2 years ago. And those things are big numbers, as I said, but they have a gradual impact that takes time to build as cars are replaced over time. And of course, as renewable energy grows from a fairly small share of overall national energy production. I think the final point I'd like to make is that it's really an industrial strategy to go for these technologies. It's not so much a near-term energy fix for short-term problems like power outages or meeting immediate demand needs. So yes, I do expect the energy transition to continue to remain a secondary priority below energy security, but it will absolutely continue.
Philip, you know, can I come to you now? Because Anders has already mentioned coal. So let me ask you, how do you think coal fits kind of into the story? Because it's discussed as a source of energy security, but it could also complicate kind of the whole longer term energy transition, especially when we've previously talked about renewables, and which of course are increasingly seen as a kind of source of energy security for China. So what's your view therefore on coal? How does it fit in?
Well, I think that a good number to hold in the mind is 50% or more. China accounts for 50% or more of global coal production and global coal consumption. Coal also accounts for more than 50% of China's primary energy consumption, though that share is declining. And in power generation, it's about 60% that coal accounts for, again, also declining in percentage. However, the country still has large reserves of coal, and production and consumption of coal are still rising. And this is still important, and this is one of the reasons why carbon dioxide emissions from energy are still rising. And coal, for decades, is seen as the most reliable source of cheap energy. Recently, senior officials have described coal as the ballast stone or foundation of the country's energy system. And this really doesn't mean to say that it's always going to be the major source of energy, but it is the fuel that can be made available quickly to address energy shortages, especially in the power sector. And we saw this in 2021 and in 2022, as well as in some earlier years, when there are shortages or disruptions for whatever reason. And one issue of particular concern is the potential for shortages of hydroelectricity if serious droughts become more frequent. So to your sort of final question there, you know, does the importance of coal complicate the low carbon transition? In the short term, yes, as we've seen in Europe, because when the lights go out, you put in more coal. And picking up on Anders' more optimistic note, in the long term, hopefully not. Coal-fired power stations are being shifted progressively to play a balancing role, and other industries are gradually shifting away from using coal.
Okay, now, Anders, perhaps kind of quite a blunt, short question to you. You know, what about climate policies and climate diplomacy then?
Yes, I do think that China will remain active on the climate diplomacy stage. And you saw that last year with China intervening at the COP to work on the topic of methane. And I think that we are all expecting that there would be some sort of policy on methane coming out this year, action plan that had been promised late last year. However, I wouldn't anticipate that this would translate into, for example, higher carbon prices or a more ambitious or large in scope carbon trading market.
So, Mikhail, you know, we've talked about energy policy changes, and indeed, of course, there's a leadership transition underway in China with new government policies to be announced, what expected in, I think, March. You know, so what have been the changes in foreign policy? And will, do you think there'll be a shift in China's attitude towards Russia?
There's been certainly a shift in tone so far. We've seen, a new lineup of foreign policy czars, I guess. The former ambassador to the US is now sort of large and in charge of China's foreign policy. And we talked about wolf warrior diplomacy, so very aggressive foreign policy stances and rhetoric. Those seem to have been softened. It's much more outreach to Western governments. Obviously, now that China's reopened, there have been visits. We've seen, the German chancellor go to China, and there are planned visits of other EU officials and sort of an ongoing parade of foreign delegates coming into China. There's also an economic needs there, right, to ensure inflows of capital, of expertise, open markets for China. Now, does this change in tone mean a fundamental shift in the way China perceives the world? I think it's too soon to say that that is happening. There is still a huge threat perception, right? We saw in the 20th Party Congress readout, there was a lot of talk about sanctions and, unilateral sanctions being imposed on China by the West, concerns about technological decoupling and this assessment that China's external environment is the worst or the most complicated it's been in a decade. I think those are unchanged. So it's more a question of tactics rather than strategy. And I think the partnership or sort of the attitudes towards Russia are not likely to visibly change. I think we also have to bear in mind, there seems to be a sense or an assessment that, and this is obviously, again, based on rhetoric, the Russian-Chinese partnership is a friendship that has no limits. I mean, we've seen that there are limits to it. Again, not in rhetorical action, but if you look at kind of investments in oil and gas in Russia, the Chinese haven't rushed to backfill companies that are leaving Russia. Yes, they've been very active in buying cheap hydrocarbons from Russia, or even not so cheap LNG last year. But I think we have to be a bit careful about how we characterize the Russia-China partnership. And with that sort of careful and ambiguous characterization, I don't expect to see a large change in the overall relationship. We've seen Chinese buyers undeterred by the G7 price cap, still buying crude from Russia and not buying it necessarily below $60 a barrel, below the kind of price cap. And, flows from Russia on the Power of Siberia are going to continue to ramp up. And China will have to kind of straddle that foreign policy rhetoric. But it does so with great ambiguity, and I think, again, will continue to do so.
So, Philip, coming back to you, can you perhaps share with our listeners some of the kind of key questions and uncertainties around energy policy making in China this year? What do you think we should be looking out for?
Well, as has been stated earlier in this podcast, China's emerging from COVID, we assume. They'll boost the economy, money into infrastructure, let the real estate sector move ahead, supporting the private sector, promoting consumption, etc. But of course, what we need to look for is what is the scale of GDP growth and what is the share of high energy intensity activity? Because that it shapes demand as much as anything else. We're likely to see an emphasis on producing more of everything in forms of energy, coal, oil, gas, renewables, nuclear, not just to support the economic growth, but to try and constrain imports. The questions on the policy side for me are how much focus will be given to energy efficiency and constraining CO2 emissions in the short term? And to what extent will they be pressing forward with power market reforms and with the national carbon market? Again, going back to what's been said before, how do we balance, pushing forward the economy and doing all these things with the climate and energy efficiency agenda? And I think overlying this, what we've seen in the last few years is that party leading groups chaired by Xi Jinping have been the focal point of many key decisions relating to industry, energy, and the economy. And, with the new government coming into place in March, will this remain the case? Or will there be more delegation to government to actually run the economy and the energy sector?
Well, Mikhail, if I can come back to you for the final question and ask you perhaps kind of to summarize and also to look ahead, you know, what would be the main issues that will keep the OIS China program busy? And also, you know, what should the listeners, our listeners, look out for over the coming year with regards to China?
So certainly to kind of echo and continue on what Philip was saying, policy volatility, right? We'll be watching for signs of how strong this sort of pro-growth agenda is. Again, on the oil front, it will be quotas and import licenses, when they are awarded and how much, whether there is green light to new refining capacity and to what extent outdated capacity is shut. The acceleration of signing LNG SPAs with, you know, foreign producers. Do we actually get regas terminals starting up, some that have been promised or pledged? The kind of role of environmental impact assessments on new projects. Again, we hear a lot about coal power plants in the pipeline, how much are actually being built, and then what are utilization rates looking like? So I guess the policy discussions and the rhetoric and then some of the implementation, but I think really implementation is important. Which messages, not just sort of which messages are being given by Beijing, but what is being heard in the provinces and how is it interpreted? I think looking at some of the provincial realities is extremely important. And we've written and talked a lot about both rhetoric and reality, but then state guidance and implementation. So we will be continuing to do that. But I think on the macro level as well, the government's ability to recalibrate policy directions and how smoothly it does that. Again, the December U-turn was very sharp. Do we get these sharp changes or do we get more discrete and perhaps sophisticated changes in the trajectory? In terms of our research work, again, we will continue a lot of the things that we've been thinking about. How do markets interact with policy signals? Again, this is a strong year for commodities across the board, but what these fits and starts could look like. Questions of power sector reform. How does it impact the transition if China accelerates or actually slows? And what does it mean, power sector reform? How is green power trading evolving in China? The role of coal, again, is an area that we continue to look at. And this debate about energy security, how is energy security defined? How is mineral security being defined? And of course, all these international linkages, both where China is dominant and the pinch points in global energy supply chains. So a busy year ahead for us, but one with lots of really interesting research and hopefully many more podcasts.
Fantastic. Well, you know, Mikhail, Anders and Philip, thank you so much for your time today. And we look forward to hearing more about how these issues in the 2023 China themes develop, which we'll, of course, cover in the OIS China Programme Research in 2023. So I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.